were spoiled, driven, self-centered, quarrelsome, jealous, mistrustful, and ever unhappy. Between them, they changed the world of paleontology. They began as mutual friends and admirers, even naming fossil species after each other, and spent a pleasant week together in 1868. However, something then went wrong between them, nobody is quite sure what, and by the following year they had developed an enmity that would grow into consuming hatred over the next 30 years. It is probably safe to say that no two people in the natural sciences have ever despised each other more. Marsh, the elder of the two by 8 years, was a retiring and bookish fellow, with a trim beard and dapper manner, who spent little time in the field and was seldom very good at finding things when he was there. On a visit to the famous dinosaur fields of Como Bluff, Wyoming, he failed to notice the bones that were, in the words of one historian, lying everywhere like logs. But he had the means to buy almost anything he wanted. Although he came from a modest background, his father was a farmer in upstate New York, his uncle was the supremely rich and extraordinarily indulgent financier, George Peabody. When Marsh showed an interest in natural history, Peabody had a museum built for him at Yale, and provided funds sufficient for Marsh to fill it with almost whatever took his fancy. Cope was born more directly into privilege. His father was a rich Philadelphia businessman, and was by far the more adventurous of the two. In the summer of 1876, in Montana, while George Armstrong Custer and his troops were being cut down at Little Bighorn, Cope was out hunting for bones nearby. When it was pointed out to him that this was probably not the most prudent time to be taking treasures from Indian lands, Cope thought for a minute and decided to press on anyway. He was having too good a season. At one point, he ran into a party of suspicious Crow Indians, but he managed to win them over by repeatedly taking out and replacing his false teeth. For a decade or so, Marsh and Cope's mutual dislike primarily took the form of quiet sniping. But in 1877, it erupted into grandiose dimensions. In that year, a Colorado schoolteacher named Arthur Lakes found bones near Morrison while out hiking with a friend. Recognizing the bones as coming from a gigantic saurian, Lakes thoughtfully dispatched some samples to both Marsh and Cope. A delighted Cope sent Lakes $100 for his trouble and asked him not to tell anyone of his discovery, especially Marsh. Confused, Lakes now asked Marsh to pass the bones on to Cope. Marsh did so, but it was an affront that he would never forget. It also marked the start of a war between the two that became increasingly bitter, underhand, and often ridiculous. They sometimes stooped to one team's diggers throwing rocks at the other team's. Cope was caught at one point jimmying open crates that belonged to Marsh. They insulted each other in print, and each poured scorn on the other's results. Seldom, perhaps never, has science been driven forward more swiftly and successfully by animosity. Over the next several years, the two men between them increased the number of known dinosaur species in America from 9 to almost 150. Nearly every dinosaur that the average person can name, Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus, Diplodocus, Triceratops, was found by one or the other of them. The notable exception being the Tyrannosaurus rex, which was found by Barnum Brown in 1902. Unfortunately, they worked in such reckless haste that they often failed to note that a new discovery was something already known. Between them, they managed to discover a species called Uintatheres anceps no fewer than 22 times. It took years to sort out some of the classification messes they made. Some are not sorted out yet. Of the two, Cope's scientific legacy was much the more substantial. In a breathtakingly industrious career, he wrote some 1,400 learned papers and described almost 1,300 new species of fossil, of all types, not just dinosaurs, more than double Marsh's output in both cases. Cope might have done even more, but unfortunately he went into a rather precipitate descent in his later years. Having inherited a fortune in 1875, he invested unwisely in silver and lost everything. He ended up living in a single room in a Philadelphia boarding house, surrounded by books, papers, and bones. Marsh, by contrast, finished his days in a splendid mansion in New Haven. Cope died in 1897, Marsh 2 years later. In his final years, Cope developed one other interesting obsession. It became his earnest wish to be declared the type specimen for Homo sapiens, that is, that his bones would be the official set for the human race. Normally, the type specimen of a species is the first set of bones found, but since no first set of Homo sapiens bones exists, there was a vacancy, which Cope desired to fill. It was an odd and vain wish, but no one could think of any grounds to oppose it. To that end, Cope willed his bones to the Wistar Institute, a learned society in Philadelphia endowed by the descendants of the seemingly inescapable Caspar Wistar. Unfortunately, after his bones were prepared and assembled, it was found that they showed signs of incipient syphilis, hardly a feature one would wish to preserve in the type specimen for one's own race. So Cope's petition and his bones were quietly shelved. There is still no type specimen for modern humans. As for the other players in this drama, Owen died in 1892, a few years before Cope or Marsh. Buckland ended up by losing his mind and finished his days a gibbering wreck in a lunatic asylum in Clapham, not far from where Mantell had suffered his crippling accident. Mantell's twisted spine remained on display at the Hunterian Museum for nearly a century before being mercifully obliterated by a German bomb in the Blitz. What remained of Mantell's collection after his death passed on to his children, and much of it was taken to New Zealand by his son Walter, who emigrated there in 1840. Walter became a distinguished Kiwi, eventually attaining the office of Minister of Native Affairs. In 1865, he donated the prime specimens from his father's collection, including the famous Iguanodon tooth, to the Colonial Museum, now the Museum of New Zealand, in Wellington, where they have remained ever since. The Iguanodon tooth that started it all, arguably the most important tooth in paleontology, is no longer on display. Of course, dinosaur hunting didn't end with the deaths of the great 19th